Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is HICS Web Services Part 1, Development. Today's presenter is Paul Cooper. Paul has been a member of the HICS development team for 10 years, and in that time has worked extensively on both the Java and the web services support in HICS. He has development responsibility for the HICS Web Services Assistance and the associated transformation service in HICS. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Paul.
Okay, thank you, Joseph. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's presentation on HICS Web Services. So this is the first of a two-part series that we're doing, looking at both the development and the deployment of web services for HICS. So today we'll be focusing on development, with a particular emphasis on the activities of the application developer. Next week, we'll be looking at deployment, and that will have more of an emphasis on configuration for production deployment. So I'd very much encourage everybody from both disciplines to attend both sessions, because they are intended to work together as a pair. Okay, so I've tried to pitch this presentation at an intermediate level, as it does go into some fairly advanced concepts, and some of the basic material is skipped over quite quickly. And there is a lot of material to get through. I hope that you'll find it useful. Okay, can we go to slide two, please? So in today's presentation, we're going to look at some of the most common development approaches for web services in HICS. We'll start out by discussing how existing common area-based programs can be exposed as web services. And we'll talk a little bit about how to deploy and test those web services. We'll then go on to look at something called top-down development of web services. And that's where we start with a WSL-based description of a service, and we'll get to that a little bit later. We're also going to discuss some of the customization opportunities, best practices, hints and tips, that sort of thing. So everything that I'm going to tell you about today will be relevant for all versions of HICS from Transaction Server 3.1 forwards, unless I specifically say otherwise. So even if you're on 3.1, most of this information will be relevant for you. Okay, so let's go to slide three, please. All right, so I like to start with these presentations where most presenters end, and share some of the most useful links to other resources that are out there. So firstly, I'd like to encourage you to use the online versions of the HICS information centres, as we do regularly update them. So for example, the information on web services in the Transaction Server 3.1 documentation, the current version of that information is rather more complete than the original version. So do make sure you're using a current refresh of that documentation. And it's also worth reviewing the docs from the latest version of HICS as well, because some of the new information that's added is relevant to the older versions too. So it's worth having those links available. We do have a rich set of red books available on various subjects that pertain to web services and HICS. A couple that I've just mentioned. We have the performance red book that was released earlier this year, so you may not have seen that one before. We're also in the middle of updating the development red book at the moment. So if you watch out for a refresh of that one a little bit later in the year, that will be coming along soon. One of the links towards the bottom of this slide is to some further examples that we've got. There's a support pack. And that goes beyond some of the information that's in the information center. So if you're new to web services in HICS, you'd like some more examples, particularly if you're using or if you're new to Rational Developer System Z, the link that's supplied there does have a good set of material to look at. And the final link at the bottom of this slide is to the HICS Web Services Knowledge Collection. And that contains an excellent set of links to other resources, including presentations, you know, like this one, but also tech notes and you know, other sources of interest. So that's a good link to have in your bookmarks collection. Slide four, please. This is my single slide overview of exposing an existing COM area-based program as a web service. And this is something we call bottom-up development. And the idea is that you start off with a pair of language structures, and those are typically going to be COBOL copybooks, and they will describe the input and the output COM area data formats of an existing KIX program. And we're going to use those as input to a JCL procedure called DFHLS to WS. That's language structure to WSDL. And what it does is it generates a couple of key artifacts, something called a WSDL file and a WSBind file. And I'm going to discuss those files shortly. So on the right-hand side of this slide, I've got an example language structure here, something for one of my unit tests. And this particular example is in COBOL, but we also support both PL1 and C. But one important point that I just wanted to mention on this slide is that although LS2WS does support a good set of COBOL data types, it doesn't support absolutely everything. So some of the most obvious constructs that aren't supported include pointers, which you shouldn't really be using in a COM area anyway, but also the occurs depending on clause and redefines. And some of the more complicated picture clauses may not necessarily be supported. So what this means is that if your COM areas rely on these data types, then you may have to tweak them slightly before they'll work through LS2WS. There are some other options that I'll talk to you about in a few slides of time, but tweaking the language structure is a fairly common practice to get around some of the minor limitations. Okay, so next slide, please. Okay, so here I've got an example fragment from a WSDL document. Now, it's deliberately just a little bit too small to comfortably read. And the point I wanted to emphasize here is that whilst the WSDL file is text-based, it's not really intended to be human-readable. It is intended to be used with tooling. But, okay, so what is WSDL? Well, very simply, it's a description of a web service, and it's intended to contain everything that a client-side developer needs to know in order to build an application that will invoke that web service. So amongst other things, it contains an XML schema-based description of the programmatic interface to that service. It also contains some transport-specific bindings, say, for example, telling the client to use the SOAP protocol over HTTP. And it also contains the endpoint on the network of the service. So that's the URI. Now, what I've done here is just highlight a small section from the WSDL. I'll show how one specific field from the source copybook to an element in the XML schema within the WSDL. And we can see that this particular element is called a single float 2. And if you skip back to the previous slide, you'll be able to see a field of that same name in my copybook. And it was of type computational 1. And here in the XML, it's been mapped to a float data type. And they're broadly equivalent. So for each field in the original copybook, there's going to be a similar field in the WSDL. Now, a few slides of time, I'm going to show you an example SOAP message. That's an XML message that will be built from this WSDL and will contain data that we can send to KIX. But for now, all I want you to be aware of is that the WSDL describes the web service. Next slide 6, please. Okay, so first let's just take a quick look at the JCL that's required to generate that WSDL. Now, I'm not going to bore you with all the descriptions of the parameters. So all that reference information is in the information center. At this point, the point I just want to make is that if you wish to integrate that JCL into existing build systems, you can do that. You can also archive it for future use. If you ever need to regenerate a bind file, to regenerate a bind file later on in time, well, you can do that. LS2WS, it does require Java to be installed on the Unix file system. And if you don't already have Java installed, it's a free download. But the version that's required does depend on the version of KIX you've got installed. Newer versions of Qt do require newer versions of Java. Slide 7, please. Okay, so this slide covers some of the odds and ends that relate to this bottom-up development scenario for web services. So far, we've only discussed COM area-based applications. But you can also use channel-based applications. If you're familiar with channels, they were new in Transaction Server 3.1. But the trick there is that you must restrict your applications to just a single container. So that is, you must be using a container as though it were a COM area, just without the length limitation. Now in Transaction Server 4.1, we've improved that. So you can now use much more complex or sophisticated channel-based applications with multiple containers. And DHLSWS has been extended so that it can expose those more sophisticated applications as web services. Okay, another bit of terminology you need to be familiar with. We talk about provider mode for web services, where provider kind of means server, I guess. And we also talk about requester mode, where requester implies clients. Now in this particular scenario, where we're starting with an existing application, then pretty much by definition that's going to be provider mode. We'll talk about the requester mode in a few slides time. Provider mode, a stack of technology in Qt, it does execute on an open LHTTP. So that in turn means that that if your applications are thread safe, then you will avoid some extra TCP switching. So thread safety is very much encouraged, but it's certainly not mandatory. It's just a good idea. Now, if you have Rational Developer for System Z, or RDZ as I'm going to be calling it from here on, then there are some extra options available to you for this bottom-up development approach. Just as a quick aside, for those of you who aren't aware of it, RDZ is primarily a development environment, COBOL platforms the COBOL applications and the Z platform. It does also support PL1, and it's got all sorts of clever features that I won't have opportunity to tell you about here. But if we just look at the Qt Web Services supports, then RDZ has two different bottom-up enablement modes. It's got something called the interpretive approach and the compiled approach. The interpretive approach makes use of DHLSWS in much the same way as I've just described, except that it wrappers it with some wizards and takes a lot of the effort out of it. But it's also a completely different technology, which is this compiled approach. And what that does is it generates the source code for something called a converter program. So COBOL source code, which you then get to compile up and deploy to your Qt runtime. But the good thing about that compiled approach is that it does have much broader support for COBOL data types. So amongst other things, it does support the curve depending on clause instruction, unlike LSWS. So if limitations with LSWS are causing you problems, then it is well worth evaluating those compiled converters in RDZ. In both cases, you're going to get both a WSL and a WSBind file produced, and the performance will be broadly similar in both cases. However, the mappings that are used by these two different technologies are not identical. And what that means is that you can't just swap from one to the other without having some kind of application rework. So you would usually choose one or the other. Slide 8. Okay, let's take a quick look at exposing an existing Qt program as a web service using the interpretive mode. And I'm going to be using RDZ version 7.5 to do that. So we start by creating a web services for Qt project, and there's a wizard to talk us through the options. There are three supported scenarios. We have the bottom-up approach that I'm telling you about at the moment, top-down, and we'll get to that shortly. But there's also something called meet in the middle, and that's where you have both an existing WSL description of a service and an existing application in Qt, and you want to wire the two of them together. So In all cases, we get to select some input files to use, and those may be local to your workspace in RDC, or they may come from a remote repository out of the mainframe. Slide 9, please. Next, we get to click on the project and select to generate web services for Kix resources. Just go straight on to slide 10, please. Okay, so next we select the input and the output data structures to use. So this is the com area. Now, under RDC, one of the nice little features is that you can identify structures from anywhere within the COBOL program. You know, you don't have to separate it out into a separate copybook first, as you would have to do with LSWS. And you can also pick which fields to include in that external web service. So if there's particular fields that you know aren't required, you can select that they shouldn't be included in the WSDL. So again, that's unlike LSWS, where the entire copybook gets exposed. And then there are further options within RDC. For changing things like the mapping parameters and the URI and various other things that I've decided to skip here for brevity. But all the things that you can set through the JCL-based interface, you can do those through the RDC wizard as well. So I guess just the point I wanted to emphasize here is that even if you're using the interpretive approach, there is some extra value in RDC over and above what the JCL interface gives you. So slide 11, please. Okay, well, we now have the option of deploying the generated artifacts, which have just been produced for us, directly into a live Kix region. So on this panel, I can select my unit testing Kix environment and a specific pipeline. I'll tell you more about pipelines in a moment, but a specific pipeline resource to use from that Kix region. And what RDC will do is it will place a copy of the WSBind file in the relevant directory out on the Unix file system, and will trigger a pipeline scan to occur. And that's going to make the WSBind file become active in Kix. It's going to cause the Kix web service resource to be installed. And that's in a live Kix region. And that in turn means that our web service is now ready for testing. Now, just as an aside, if you don't want the resources to be deployed into a live test region, you don't have to do that. You know, this last step was optional. So let's just go to slide 12, please. So next we'll want to test the web service. So unfortunately, that does require more than just a web browser. You actually need a client application. And there are some good tools out there to help you generate test applications, including something called the Web Services Explorer, which is included in both RDC and in the underlying Eclipse platform. So if you don't have RDC, you can do what I'm about to show you using the free Eclipse product. And if you follow the link at the bottom of this page, that will show you a step-by-step guide to doing just that. But basically, you right-click on the WSDL document within RDC, and it will generate a test program for you. And there's literally about 3 or 4 mouse clicks involved. And the result of that is a form, in which you can enter example values for each of the fields in the input to the web service. And you can see a part of that form on the right-hand side of this slide. Slide 13. Okay, so you can also switch to an XML representation of the data, and that's what I've shown you here. So you can see the values that I've entered, but you can now see them surrounded by the angle brackets and all the XML markup. And in addition to that, you can also see part of the SOAP envelope here. Now, SOAP is it's a messaging protocol that's used, but I'm not going to be talking about this in any detail in this presentation. You just need to know it's there under the covers. And so you can see a few of those tags on this slide. So once you're happy with your input data, you can hit the Go button. And RDC will open up a HTTP connection to Kix and will send that SOAP message to the Kix region. And Kix is going to receive it, it's going to read through all that XML, and it's going to convert it into a COM area, which is consistent with the copybook that we started off with. It's then going to link to the application, passing it that con area. And the application, of course, then does whatever it does, and it's going to pass back the output data. And Kix is going to generate XML from that, wrapper it with the necessary scope tags, and return it to RDC, where it ends up being displayed. And it can be as simple as that. Within RDC, what we've just done is we've exposed an existing Kix program as a web service. We've deployed the required artifacts to Kix, and we've tested the resultant web service, and that's all just been in a few minutes. Slide 14, please. What if something goes wrong? Well, normally, something called a soap fault message we return to the requester. And that's like an exception in Java or a bad response code in the Kix API. And in most cases, there's going to be a DFH PI message issued by Kix. And in many cases, a copy of that message will be included in the fault message that's sent back to the client. So that's going to be a starting point for trying to figure out what's happened. And now there are a whole lot of things that potentially can go wrong, and the diagnostics required to solve such problems can differ in each case. So I'm not going to be going into all the problem determination details here, but instead what I'm going to do is remind you of a webcast like this one that was done early on in the year, back in June I believe, on Kix Web Services Structure and Debugging. And that went into some of the problem determination skills. So that presentation and the associated audio recording are available online from the WSTE website. But what I am going to mention now is the web service validation feature. And that's something you can optionally turn on in Kix for a particular web service. And what that does for you is it causes a whole lot of extra XML validation to be done at execution time. So it's quite a heavyweight process. So it involves linking to a Java program in Kix. And that Java program is going to scan through all that XML and make sure that it's consistent with the XML schema from the WSTL that we started off with. So it's really quite useful during application development, but we don't generally recommend it for production use. Slide 15, please. Some organisations find it useful to have a global registry of services that are available within their organisation. And we do have an IBM product that specialises in addressing that sort of requirement. That's the Web Service Registry and Repository, WSRR. So it's quite easy to publish WSTL from RDC that's been generated into WSRR. If you want to do that. If you don't have RDC, but you do want to publish WSRR, then we have a support pack, DA1A, and that provides a JSDR-based interface to do the same thing. And in Transaction Server 4.1, we've actually integrated that support pack directly into the product itself, so it's actually part of LS to WS in Transaction Server 4.1. Slide 16, please. We've looked at generating WSTL from an existing com area based program. And you can give that WSTL directly to your client-side developers and let them go away and use it. And of course, many shops do just that. However, what I normally recommend is that the WSTL is customized first. So the WSTL I've generated may be good enough, but it's very unlikely to be perfect. And there are many things in there that you could choose to change. Things like field names, namespaces, perhaps you would want to remove unwanted content. You could combine multiple generated WSTL documents together into one service. Or indeed, you could add constructs to assist with change control in the future, or indeed, whatever it requires to turn this service into something that addresses a particular business requirement. So, if you do end up changing the generated WSTL, then you're going to have to reprocess that using our top-down tooling. And I'm going to tell you about that in a moment. But in so doing, the whistle becomes the source for the document. Sorry, it becomes the source for the service, rather than the original copybooks. So a new set of language structures are going to get generated by that top-down tooling. That in turn can require application changes. So you may end up writing a wrapper program to map between the new and the old interfaces, or indeed updating the existing program. So, you know, what this means, of course, is that customizing the WSDL can require a lot more effort. But it can also result in better services. So I consider this to be an advanced thing to do, and in practice, most deployments don't do this, but I think it's a good idea. Slide 17, please. A further consideration is the granularity of services. So it's rarely a good idea to expose, you know, every single Kix program as a web service. A good web service will usually wrapper an entire function in Kix, an application, and that in turn will typically be made up of many individual programs. Now, one feature within RDZ that you might find useful in this context is the service flow modeler. And what that can do is it can be used to aggregate multiple Kix programs together without coding into something called a microflow web service. And this microflow, it can include terminal-based programs, BMS, but also COM area-driven programs. And in so doing, by creating these composite web services, you end up creating composite web services without having to write new application code. And if you like the idea of aggregating services together, you can go on to use other products, such as WebSphere Process Server, to include Kix-based web services and microflows into wider workflow projects within your organization. Slide 18, please. Okay, so one final concept that we do need to talk about is the mapping and runtime levels for a Kix web service. So the runtime level is the minimum version of Kix that a particular distributed client file can be installed into. Whereas the mapping level is the version of the interface, the programmatic interface that's shared between Kix and the applications. So in most cases, they're going to be the same. If you build a WSBind file that uses, for example, mapping level 2.1, then it can only be installed into a version of Kix that supports at least mapping level 2.1. Now, over time, we've introduced new mapping capabilities, new options to Kix. And where these new capabilities change the application bindings, then we've created a new mapping level at the same time. And you have to explicitly opt in to the mapping level that you want to use. So normally we recommend that you use the most recent mapping level that's available to you. So if you're on Transaction Server 3.1, then it's very much recommended that you use mapping level 1.2 for new web services. And if you're on Transaction Server 3.2, then we recommend mapping level 2.2. So you may have to apply the relevant enablement APARs first. So the one scenario where it does make sense to use an older mapping level is where you have to regenerate a WSBind file for an existing web service. So if you have an existing service at, for example, mapping level 1.1, and you want to change the URI that it's associated with, then you can do so at the old mapping level, and that will ensure that the application bindings remain unchanged. Just one thing to note, each new version of Kix does continue to support all of the older mapping levels. So migrating to a new version of Kix should not involve any application changes, at least not for web services. Slide 19, please. That's enough about the bottom-up approach to web services. Let's take a look at the top-down approach. And this is where we start from an existing WSDL document, and we either implement or invoke the web service. So in this case, we have a different JCL-based tool called DFHWS2LS. That's WSDL to language structure, and that generates as output a set of language structures and a WFI file. In this scenario, we do very much encourage you to validate that the WSDL you're using is valid before trying to enable it for Kicks. So we do see quite a lot of support calls into IBM over WSDL that has been manually edited and contains subtle errors of some kind. So both RDC and the Free Eclipse tool, they both contain very good validators for doing this. So my example document here, you see I inserted a silly error, just as an example. Slide 20. Okay, so here we have some general advice for top-down development. So one of the problems that we have mapping WSDL into COBOL is that flattened COBOL structures aren't very effective at describing some of what's possible in WSDL. And the result of that is that the COBOL bindings that are generated are usually more complicated than the original WSDL bindings. And of course, the more complicated the WSDL is, the more complicated the COBOL gets. So anything you can do to simplify the WSDL will help with that conversion to COBOL. Now, once you've generated your COBOL bindings, language structures, then you'll have to write an application that implements or invokes that web service. Now, if you use RDC, it can help you with that, as it generates some template code into which you can add your application logic. So that just helps you to get started. One other little aside at this point, for top-down development, the scenario we start with WSDL, RDC only has the interpretive mode. There isn't a compiled mode equivalent for top-down. As with the bottom-up approach, there are lots of options in WSDLS to customize the data mappings. So if you don't like the default mappings, in many cases, there is going to be some input parameter that you can configure to change them. Slide 21, please. Okay, so some of the decisions that are taken during the web service enablement process can have quite a significant impact on the runtime performance of the web service. So once again, anything you can do to simplify the web service is advisable. But just the two general considerations to bear in mind are that larger volumes of data impact performance, and larger numbers of XML tags also impact performance. So the amount of data and the complexity of the structure of that data. And there's a red paper with a link at the bottom here that describes these issues for a real application. I'd also recommend reviewing the performance red book for further information and guidance. Slide 22, please. Okay. So let's take a look at developing a requester mode application top-down. So in this scenario, we're going to be implementing a client program in Kicks. So there's an API command that the application will have to call, execkicks invoke web service. TS4.1, incidentally, we've created a synonym, execkicks invoke service. It's the same thing. Either way, you have to identify the name for web service resource that is installed in Kicks. You also have to specify an operation to invoke on that service. So one little tip, it is a good idea at the time that you run WSDLS to specify which of the operations which are available on that service you actually want to use. If you do just specify the operations you want to use, then that avoids generating a whole lot of COBOL code and the associated metadata. So you avoid generating stuff that you're never going to need to use. So the ability to do that was new in Transaction Server 3.2, but if you have RDC, then you'll have that capability, even if you end up deploying to Transaction Server 3.1. It's also a good idea to think about timeouts, just in case the remote web service doesn't reply in an acceptable time. So for TS3.1, you have to do that by setting a D timeout for the transaction. In Transaction Server 3.2, you can set a default timeout to the entire pipeline, and you can actually override that for each use of the pipeline if you really need to do so. Just one other thought here, if it's possible to do so, it's a good idea to avoid holding resource locks, you know, across an invoke command. They can take quite a long time to complete in relative terms. So slide 23, please. Okay, so you'll also need to specify the URI, the location out on the network, at which the remote web service can be found. And there are several mechanisms for doing that. The remote location may have been indicated in the source WSDL document, in which case KIX will already know that endpoint and will be able to use it automatically. But the application can supply a URI programmatically. Now in Transaction Server 4.1, we've actually extended the invoke command to allow you to specify a client mode URI map resource on that invoke if you wish to do so. That's just another way of providing the URI. Another mechanism, fairly advanced one, if you want to, you could have something called a handler program in the pipeline and have it supply the URI, perhaps doing something like a query to WSRR, yeah, dynamically. We'll talk about handler programs shortly. So if the remote web service requires the use of SSL, and if you wish to specify a client certificate or a specific set of ciphers to use, then again, the mechanism you have to use does depend on the version of KIX. Transaction Server 3.1, KIX uses the default certificate and ciphers for the whole region. In TS 3.2, you can configure a client mode URI map for that information, and KIX will find it automatically as the outbound connection is established and respect the information from that URI map. And as I just described in 4.1, you can actually explicitly specify a URI map with that information. And just incidentally, you're not limited to using HTTP and HTTPS for the transport for web services. You can also use WebSphere MQ as the transport protocol. And if you do that, there'll be a slightly different style of URI. It uses the JMS style rather than HTTP. Slide 24, please. Okay, so the other scenario where top-down development is important is where you implement a service from existing WSDL. And this may be WSDL that you've previously generated and customized, or it may be WSDL derived from some other source. And the main difference is that we're going to write a program to implement that service. At runtime, the program is going to be passed a channel, and there'll be a whole set of containers on there, some of which the application will need to read. So, one such container is the dfhws-operation container, and that has within it the operation name. And the application data itself, that will be found in the dfhws-data container. And there will be other containers, application-specific containers, as required. A SOAP-aware provider mode program can also return explicit SOAP fault messages using the exec-kick SOAP faults API. If you don't use that, well sorry, if the application abends for any reason, then KIX will automatically generate you a SOAP fault with the diagnostics. But for an application that wishes to do so, it can provide application-specific diagnostics through that API. Slide 25, please. Right, so sometimes it's useful to write programs that interface directly with the XML and opt out of all of the KIX supplied data transformation. And if you want to do that, there's several ways that you can. So in provider mode, you can create your own application handler program to replace DHCPITP. I'll mention that in just a moment. Or in requester mode, you can call the exec linkable DHCPIRT pipeline, pipeline program. And in both cases, you can then interact directly with the control containers from the pipeline. And the information center has details on how to do that. Now in TS 3.2, we also have the option of generating an XML-only WSBind file using WS2LS or indeed RDC. And this is similar to a regular WSBind file, except that no language structure is generated, and the application is expected to work directly with the contents of the DFHWS-body container. But that's raw XML. And the advantage of using that technique over the mechanisms from 3.1 is that you have a single deployment model, and you get all the advantages of having a web service resource. And that includes validation, invoke API, stats, monitoring, the operation resolution, shared diagnostics, that kind of thing. So if you do decide to opt out of these kit-supplied mappings, then there are a whole set of different technologies out there that can help you work with XML. That includes converter programs from RDZ, something called the transform command, which is the new thing in 4.1. But of course, there's also the XML path command from COBOL, and there's a number of vendor products that do this kind of thing. One scenario that I have seen several times is where Java's being used in Kix, in which case it's more convenient to use one of the many Java technologies that exist for working with XML, rather than having your Java program pretend to be COBOL. Slide 26, please. Okay, so some WSL documents, unfortunately, are not supported by WS2LS. Now, over time, a list of unsupported constructs has shrunk quite significantly, but it's still worth making sure that you're using the very best mapping level that's available to you, because it's quite possible that whatever problem you experience has been fixed at the later mapping level. It's also worth validating your WSL first, as, again, sometimes subtle errors in the WSL can fool WS2LS. But even taking that into account, there are some constructs that are not yet supported in WS2LS. I've listed a few here, including recursion and something called SOAP encoding, an old technology, and also specifying min and max recursive attributes on a sequence tag. Just for those of you who are familiar with XML, we do support min and max recursive on elements, which is where you normally see them in XML. This restriction is specifically about sequences. Okay, so what can you do if WS2LS does not support your WSL document? Well, one option is to work directly with the XML, as described on the previous slide. But sometimes another option is to modify a local copy of the WSL and replace problematic constructs with something else, such as an any tag in XML. And if you do that, then the application will be presented with the raw XML for that subset of the data that the Kix can't handle. So unfortunately, the any tag itself has only been supported from mapping level 2.1 onwards, but that's a technique for TS 3.2. Another option you can use to introduce a whole extra tier into the processing that can map between the original SOAP data and a simplified version that Kix can cope with. If you want to do that kind of thing, then WebSphere Data Power Appliance can help, or indeed a broker, such as the WebSphere Enterprise Service Bus, WebSB. Incidentally, if you are invoking a remote web service which is particularly data intensive or XML verbose, then you may actually find that having a middle tier to strip out some of the excessive and unneeded markup can actually significantly reduce the CPU impact in Kix. So sometimes it's worth considering that kind of thing, even if the WSL is supported by WS2LS. Slide 27, please. So let's take a brief look at the resources that are needed in Kix to support a web service. So in provider mode, you're going to need four resources, typically. You're going to need a TCP/IP service that implements the HTTP protocol. You're going to need a URI map, and that identifies the specific processing for a particular URI. And amongst other things, it's going to identify the pipeline to use and the web service to use. The pipeline itself, it indicates a set of shared policies of service for a group of web services. And then you have the individual web service resource, and that identifies application-specific processing. Slide 28, please. Okay, so I've mentioned this WSBind file quite a lot of times already, and I've not really told you a great deal about it yet. So it contains all the metadata that Kix needs in order to do these XML transformations at runtime. But it also includes some deployment information, including things like the URI which the services are exposed. And the bind file, once it's deployed to Kix, becomes encapsulated with the web service resource. So for each provider mode web service in Kix, we're typically going to need two specific resources, a web service and a URI. There's a mechanism for dynamically discovering WS bind file out from a particular directory on the Unix file system. So you can do something called a scan command, issue a pipeline scan, and Kix will detect all those WS bind files that are either new or changed, and it will install web service and URI map resources as required. And in fact, that's what we did earlier using RDC. Again, just a little aside, you don't have to use the pipeline scan mechanism, and if you prefer to use traditional Kix CSV definitions, you can do that. Some shops do prefer to do that for production environments. It's entirely optional. Slide 29, please. We also have a WS bind file viewer and editor in RDC, and you can use that to actually change deployment characteristics for a WS bind file if you wish to do so. So you right-click on the bind file and you select Edit, and once you're in there, there's some things you can change, like the transaction ID and the sync on return flag and the URI and that kind of thing. If you don't have RDC, we have support PAX CS04, provides the same capability from a Unix command prompt. However, the support pack does require at least Kix CS 3.2, whereas RDC will work even if you only have Kix CS 3.1. Slide 30, please. So I've mentioned that the pipeline specifies shared qualities of service for a set of web services. It's configured using an XML configuration file, and that provides you with some extensive customization opportunities. So you can add things called handler programs for pipeline to perform specialist processing. Now Kix provides a number of such capabilities that you can opt into, including WSAT, distributed two-phase commit, WS security for sophisticated identity propagation, and we have MTOM XOP in Transaction Server 3.2, which is all about binary wire-level optimizations. But you can add your own handlers in to implement local requirements as part of this processing. So you get a set of control containers that are used to drive the pipeline at runtime. And each handler program has access to those containers and has the option to change them in order to control the subsequent processing. And in provider mode, there's something called the terminal handler, which sits at the very end of the pipeline, and it's normally going to be one of the Kix supplied SOAP handlers. There's also an application handler, and that will normally be set to DFHPITP, and that's the Kix program that implements the data conversions. And it in turn links to the target application program. Let's go on to slide 31, please. Now, it is possible to have both a web service requester and a web service provider application hosted in the same Kix system. If you do that, and an invoke web service command targets a provider mode web service, then Kix recognizes that the target is local, and it actually optimizes that entire invocation down to a link, an ExecKix link. Obviously, that significantly improves the performance as we don't end up going down the pipelines and out to the network. But that, in turn, can offer some interesting new some options for doing new COBOL development, because you could decide to implement your new COBOL applications as web services, whilst having them continue to interact with each other and perform like ordinary programs. So the advantage being that you have a standards-based interface between those COBOL applications, even if you have no intention of ever exposing them as web services to outside callers. So in TS 4.1, we've taken that idea and we've added a few new options. So you can do these kind of local optimizations, but still have some pipeline processing. So in 4.1, that gives you some more flexibility. You can choose how much pipeline-like processing to have between programs and kids. Slide 32, please. Okay, so let's just take a quick look at the differences, you know, what's new in 3.2 compared to 3.1. And the main difference, for web services at least, is that in 3.2, web services perform a whole lot better. And that's partly due to the use of 64-bit containers, and it's partly due to some changes in code page support, and there have been thread safety enhancements and HTTP enhancements and various other things. But you know, across the board, every web service workload that we've measured has been faster in 3.2 than in 3.1. We also, of course, have support for more data mapping options, especially top-down. So we've got support for something called the AnyTag in XML and for polymorphic XML. And we've got support for some more infrastructure specifications, NTOM XOP, WSDL 2.0, and WS Trust. Slide 33, please. If we do the same comparison between 4.1 and 3.2, then once again, one of the most noticeable differences is with performance. So most web service workloads will run faster in 4.1 than they did in 3.2, and that's mostly due to a rewrite of the spoke loading kicks. Though we've also made a small part of that processing offloadable now to Xamarin Speciality Engines, if you have them. Once again, we've got support for more data mapping options, including truncated data structures and timestamps. And we've got that bottom-up support for channel-based applications. We've also added support for WS addressing. But one of the other new things that we've done is we've taken the XML transformation service and we've wrapped that with an XFKix transform API so that you can now use it programmatically to do other stuff. So, for example, you can use that API to help you write handler programs or to parse fault messages, that sort of thing. Slide 34, please. Okay, almost at the end now. So in summary, Kix offers a whole lot of new options for working with web services. And we've got this whole ecosystem of related products that do add value, you know, around the edges. Now, next week, we've got part two, and Nigel Williams will be presenting, and he's going to address some of the major deployment considerations for Kix Web Services, including security and workload management, and a bit on performance. So I'd very much encourage you to come back next week for that. And if you're interested in having a play with RDZ, then we do have a 60-day free trial available from the IBM Passport Advantage website. You can go take a look at that if you fancy. Slide 35, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide online resources for Kix. So we've got the transaction server support webpage, got a whole variety of different technical information out there. You can visit the Kix featured documents link. That gives you the most requested documents, as well as those that have been identified as particularly valuable for answering questions. There's the My Notifications link on all of the product support pages, and that will sign you up for a weekly email update for products that are of interest to you. The link to webcasts for Kix and Omegamon, that points you to the webcasts, kind of like this one, and conference information. And down at the bottom, we've also got the IBM Education Assistant there. And that consists of self-help modules to help get new users up the learning curve. Okay, so now reached the end of the presentation. So I thank you very much for your attention. I do hope this has been useful. And I'm now going to pass the presentation back to Joseph.
Thank you, Paul, for a wonderful presentation. At this point, Danielle, we would like to open the lines for questions.
A question from Eman Batwell, your line is open.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I have a question. We want to do a bottom-up type of development for exposing some of our CICS programs as web services. So do we absolutely need to have the RDZ tool?
No, you don't. Absolutely not. RDV is nice. It has all sorts of great features, but no, it's certainly not a requirement. In one of the early slides, I showed you how to use the JCL to generate all those artifacts. And that's all you need. Most folks, I would suggest, just use the JCL-based interface. I like RDV, so that's why I'm sort of promoting it a little here, but you don't need it now.
Okay. I have another question regarding our programs. Like, they use pointers, and also they use the depending on in the structures in the copybooks. So in that case, we may not be able to directly convert the copybooks into WSDLs, but we could write a separate, like a driver.
Yes, that's one of the simplest ways to get around it, yes. So if you write a wrapper program that, you say, it acts as a driver and maps between something that the Kix tools can support and turns that into what you really wanted. And of course, you then have the option of whether you want to have that as a separate program or whether you actually want to evolve the original program to the new interface. You can go either way on that.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Daniel. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.